KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. You're hearing the iconic sound of helicopters from the 1979 film Apocalypse Now. Our guest for the next hour, Walter Murch, won one of his three Oscars for the sound mixing on that movie. But on top of his illustrious Hollywood career, Walter Murch has a hobby you might not expect: astrophysics. He'll join us in the next hour to talk about astrophysics, sound editing, and his work with a number of great directors, including a frequent collaborator of his, Francis Ford Coppola. It's all coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Acclaimed film editor and sound designer Walter Murch has been in Hollywood for over half a century, working on such films as Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, and The English Patient. But the three-time Oscar winner also moonlights in a field you might not expect: astrophysics. In his spare time, he steps away from the big screen and essentially tries to prove the Titius-Bode law, which is a 240-year-old theory on the spacing of the planets in the solar system. Walter Murch joins us to discuss his work in astrophysics and connections he sees between astronomy and sound editing. And we'll get into a lot of other things, no doubt, in the course of this hour. Good to have you back with
us. Thank you, Michael. Very good to be here.
You know, I learned a lot about you in this book that I didn't know. And just let me mention this, first of all, that your dad was actually a pretty well-known painter. And what is described in the book is the book I'm referring to is Lawrence Wexler's book called Waves Passing in the Night, about the astrophysics that, shall we say, Walter has been dabbling with now for a number of years. I mean, this was a stable of painters. He was one of the few realists, but Rothko was in there, and Jackson Pollock, and Clifford Still.
That's right, yeah. He exhibited at Betty Parsons Gallery on 57th Street, but all the other painters at that time, this is in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s, were abstract expressionists, but he was the rogue element who maintained still a realistic style of painting, although he painted enigmatic objects, mostly discarded, cast-off technological objects, but in mysterious combination with onions and other geometric signs. So he was called a magic realist at the time.
Yeah, and I like the work. I mean, it reminded me of some of the magic realist writers, actually.
Yes.
I also learned in reading this book, again, something I didn't know, that you provoked the first sampling lawsuit of the present era.
That's correct. As far as I know, it was back in 1971, 72, and George Lucas and I were working on THX 1138, and I was editing the sound and mixing the sound. And there was one scene that called for a repetitive squeaking motion, and as a kind of tribute to Pierre Henry, a musique concrète composer from France, I took a recording of a section of that, of one of his pieces, and made a loop out of it. This is back in the technology of 35 millimeter film. There's no digital, nothing digital was on the horizon yet.
The Middle Ages by today's standards.
Absolutely. And then just laid that sound in, which was a squeak, a repetitive squeak from a barn door that Pierre Henry had recorded. And that became one of the elements in the background sound for the scene. But then 6 months later, Pierre Henry went to see the film because somebody said, you should see this film. It's got an interesting soundtrack. And in the middle of looking at the film, he heard one of his squeaks. And a couple of weeks later, we got a letter from Warner Brothers saying, we are being sued by this record company in France for improper use of one of their recordings. In the end, it got settled. I think somebody determined that I had changed it enough out of context, and it was short enough a clip. But I think historically it probably is the first sampling lawsuit.
Yeah, we're talking to Walter Murch, film editor and sound designer, in the book I alluded to. by Lawrence Waxler is a book called Waves Passing and the Night. And we're going to get into that book to some degree. And he's going to be in conversation with the author, tonight at the Mechanics Institute Library and Chess Room in San Francisco from 6 to 9. That's why we brought him in from Bolinas. Let me also say that I've known Walter for many years, and I've always been impressed with his intelligence, to put it mildly. He's a polymath. I remember Francis Ford Coppola saying on air that you were the only true intellectual and the most intelligent man in Hollywood. Oh, you're blushing. It's okay. But I wanted to say that because when you get into stuff like astrophysics, I mean, you're getting into territory that most people really find. I mean, there are jokes about it. You're talking to an astrophysicist all that rest of that kind of stuff. But I really want to get into it in ways that maybe I hope will be understandable to the lay public. Because we're talking about some pretty difficult stuff here. Let's talk about what was advanced long ago and has fallen into disrepute, because that's really what you're trying to revive here.
Yes. This is an observation that was made in the 18th century, 250 years ago, and I ran across it in a book by Arthur Koestler called Sleepwalkers, a wonderful book which I would recommend to anyone who's interested in the history of man's evolving concept of the cosmos. And Koestler was writing about the Pythagoreans and their concept, and in talking about the numerological aspects of some of their observations, he had a footnote. The footnote led me to what was called Bode's Law, which was this observation made by two German astronomers in the 18th century, Johann Titius and Johann Bode, that if you have a relatively simple kind of ninth grade algebra algorithm, a formula, and you put integers in one end of this formula, a number of fractions pop out the other end, and the relationship between these fractional numbers has an uncanny congruence with the relative distances of the planets from the sun. And this was just a curious observation that was made. But this sequence of numbers predicted, as numbers tend to do, that there should be something at a certain distance where nobody knew that there was anything. And when the first planet was discovered by a telescope by William Herschel in 1780, the planet, to the delight of seventh grade boys everywhere, Uranus, it fit this iteration. It fit within what was predicted. And then when the center of the asteroid belt was discovered 20 years later, that also fit. And so something that seemed kind of casual both described what was known at the time, and then as subsequent discoveries were made, these predictions found out to be true. And at that point, this observation was blessed with the name Law, which is still a contentious observation.
Now these are this is all about gravitational waves, though, and it's astronomical theory, but it's also something that has to do with. We're not talking about the music of the spheres here, but we're talking about a kind of music, really, aren't we?
Yes. The original Pythagorean idea of what was called music of the spheres was a intuition that they had way back then. This is 2,500 years ago, that planets were like jewels embedded in a crystal globe of some kind. And as the globe or the sphere revolved around the Earth, it rubbed up against the next globe, which had its own planet embedded in it. So these things were in contact with each other, these crystal globes, and so they must have made a sound, and that was what Pythagoras called music of the spheres. So that was an actual physical sound. But what I'm talking about are just the ratios of the planets to each other. And what I discovered after I had gone down this rabbit hole for a couple of months, I certainly wasn't looking for this, but what I discovered was that these ratios are actually also musical ratios.
And then where's one to go with that? Composing? Symphonies?
Yeah, I mean, the relationship between human beings and music is a long and...
And music and mathematics.
And mathematics is a long and wonderful romance. and I don't know what to make of it other than it is rather beautiful.
The aesthetics of it.
Yeah.
We're talking to Walter Murch, and by the way, he'll be in conversation with journalist Lawrence Waxler tonight at the Mechanics Institute Library, talking about this from 6 to 9 and talking about it in greater depth. I thought we would talk to you about sound as well this hour. The book, by the way, is Waves Passing in the Night. It's got Walter looking like a conductor on the cover, along with musical notes in procession, Saturn, Jupiter.
Yeah, these are the notes on the cover are actually notes that Johann Kepler, the scientist in the middle of the early in the 17th century, also had a theory of the music of the solar system. What he was describing was the various speeds of the planets as they go around the sun. He was a Copernican. He believed in the solar center, the center of the solar system was the sun, and that the Earth went around. And the Earth's particular note was the two notes, mi and fa. And Kepler observed that this is appropriate because here on Earth we experience misery and famine.
Kepler, I know, is one of your icons. I'm going to make a transition in film by asking who your icons there are, putting you on the spot. But before we do that,
sure.
Here in this book that I've been alluding to is something about the sun that I found fascinating. He says about you, Walter, he's the sort of person who, driving back and forth between his Bolinas homestead and various studios in San Francisco, will take to wondering on a cubic inch basis which emits most energy, the sun or human brain, and then will set figuring it all out, looking up the requisite figures on Wikipedia and then calculating in his head. That indeed, if you reached in and pulled out an average 20-watt brain size, 80 cubic inch handful from the inside of the sun, determined again on an overall average basis, it would turn out that the human brain emits 56,000 times more wattage than the same volumetric amount of sun, or anyway, as one wag noted when being so informed, his does.
I think it's everybody. Everybody's brain puts out 20 watts of energy. It's like a 20-watt light bulb that's on all the time, even when you're asleep.
Well, you want to talk about your icons in film? I think one of them, it's safe to say, was Orson Welles, because I remember when you brought back Sound and brought back Taste of Evil.
Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil, excuse me, yeah. I was at that screening at Lucas Ranch, in fact.
Welles is, and the people who, in a sense, pushed me to go in the direction of film were the French directors Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut, also Kurosawa in Japan, and Bergman in Sweden, Fellini in Italy, and Orson Welles.
It's quite a selection. And you've worked with some of the great filmmakers. I mentioned Coppola.
No, I've been very lucky.
Well, or they've been very lucky. I mean, you know, you've done some extraordinary work, and I thought maybe we'd have a sampling of some of the work that you've done. And let me begin by talking about The Godfather with you. I just want to talk about it with you because a lot of people may not know that during post-production, one of the most famous scenes in The Godfather is Michael Corleone, of course, with the police commissioner.
Right.
The noise that we hear, which is underground railway noise, I mean, that was not in the original script. That was you.
It was not in the book, nor was it in the script. And the evolution of that particular decision was Francis's decision and Nino Rota's decision to have very powerful music come in at the end of the scene after Michael has assassinated Sollozzo and McCluskey, the two people who had conspired against his father. And to elevate the impact of that music, Francis wanted to have no music throughout the whole scene prior to that, which is an understandable aesthetic decision. What complicated it is that perhaps half of the scene is in Italian and without any subtitles, which when you think about it, it's a kind of a remarkable thing at any time in film history, let alone in 1972 when that film was made. And yet, nonetheless, the scene is a powerful scene because we, the audience, are thrown back into looking at these two individuals dueling with each other and watching very carefully their body language and what the tone of their voice. Unless you speak Italian, you don't actually know what it is that they're saying. Even given that, though, it's a long scene, and Francis and I felt that it needed something, and it wasn't going to be music, so what could it be? And I grew up in New York, in Morningside Heights, not too far away from where that theoretical restaurant was in the Bronx, and I knew that there were, crisscrossing that area of the Bronx, were many elevated subway lines, and that they provided this continuous accompaniment to people's lives who live in that area. So I thought, well, let's try that. And so we recorded in New York the sound of these elevated trains passing by, and then one particular one as it came to a stop with that kind of really grating sound of the metal wheels rubbing up against the brakes. And we played that sound throughout the scene, coming and going, as if it was a kind of low music, a sort of string section, so to speak, yet one that was in the environment of the restaurant where they were eating. There was nothing visual that triggered this. You never see the subway tracks. You never see the train. It's never established in any other way other than by the sound. But as the scene develops and becomes more tense, this sound, this rumble comes and then it goes away, and then it comes back again slightly louder when Michael is trying to find the gun in the bathroom, and then it goes away, and then he finds the gun and it gets louder, and then it goes away again. And then, if you remember the film, Clemenza had told him, when you come out of the bathroom, come out blasting. And Michael comes out of the bathroom and doesn't. So the audience is wondering what is happening. Now he sits down, and now the sound comes back with a vengeance. It gets louder and louder and louder as Michael is simply sitting there, and the camera moves in on Al Pacino. And then this squealing, screeching sound starts to accompany the rumbling, and it reaches a very loud level, almost as if the camera is underneath the train as it's coming to a stop. And at the apex of that, Michael suddenly stands up, pulls the trigger, and the noise of the gun, the noise of the shot, kills the sound of the train. So the train and the everything disappears instantly, and you're left in silence. And then Michael turns, drops the gun, leaves the restaurant, and then the music comes in.
It's fascinating because, you know, you watch a film like that, and you never even imagine those kind of nuances until afterward you hear somebody like you letting us know and giving us a full dimensional view of it.
It's interesting because many people don't even hear that sound.
Yeah.
And yet it's being played so loudly. The peculiar alchemy of sound and image is that sound will inform the image. So many people looking at that scene without even realizing it say subconsciously to themselves, that sound is the sound of Michael's neurons rubbing against each other because he's having to make this difficult decision.
Which prompts me to ask you, go back many years, we did a conference together about creativity. What is more creative to you as an editor, doing things related, like you just mentioned, to sound, or doing just film editing, which you've done as well, which, you know, many
right.
people say is so instrumental in success or failure of a film as much as even the sounds in the film.
Yeah, my first love is sound because I as I said, I grew up in New York, and in around 1953, when tape recorders were first becoming available to the general public, it was a new invention after the Second World War. A friend of mine, his father had one for, I guess, business reasons, and so I would go over to his apartment and play with this recorder, and I just fell in love with it. It's inexplicable to me, but I understood almost immediately that you could record something and then play it back, but then you could cut the tape and you could splice the tape in different orders, tape it together, turn it upside down, flip it, play it through the back of the emulsion. Basically, I was inventing a kind of film editing, except it's tape sound editing, before I knew that such a thing existed.
I thought we'd hear something else of the sound that's associated with some of the work you've done through the years. And this is from Apocalypse Now. We may want to set this up for us because the helicopters come in a central role. It's sort of like they're the cavalry almost.
Right. Yeah, that's Air Cav is what their name was.
Can we hear? Let's talk about the conception of that. I mean, it almost as if you wanted to identify the Vietnam War with helicopters, but Right. Then the music becomes indispensable,
sure.
too.
Well, this is John Milius at work. He was the person who, in writing the screenplay, who decided that Colonel Kilgore would be playing the Ride of the Valkyries as he attacked the village.
And bringing those two together... Talk about that.
Yeah, it was. It had its dramatic moments. The I started working on Apocalypse Now after the film was shot, and I was one of three, sometimes four, editors working simultaneously on it. But at a certain point, that's the scene that I was assigned to by Francis to work on. And already having decided that we would use the Valkyries, a decision had been made long before I got on the film to use this particular recording of the Valkyries, which is Schulte and the Vienna Philharmonic, 1966. It's a famous recording of that piece of music. And, you know, you... You make all of the kind of decisions about where there should be, where the music should be loud, where it should suddenly disappear, to have the maximum visceral effect upon the audience, but also to function within the needs of the particular scene. And a crisis erupted I'd say a month or 2 months before the film had to be released, which was that somebody checking boxes realized that we had never gotten permission to use this particular recording. This is sort of a
You assume Wagner's in the public domain.
Well,
or
but it's the recording. It's the particular recording of it. And so we set out on three different paths. One of them was Francis would continue, would ask Decca for the rights to do that. He did ask, and they said no. And so that intensified the problem. I then went out and got every recording of the Valkyries that there was at the time at Tower Records over here on Columbus.
No longer there.
No longer there. I think of it every time I drive past. And we also made arrangements to record the Valkyries with the San Francisco Symphony, with Francis's father, Carmine, conducting in as close a match as we could get to the Schulte meters.
Hold that thought, Walter.
Yes,
you
I'm holding that thought.
We have music coming up, and I'm going to invite listeners to join us in conversation with Walter Murch, not only about his great work in sound and film editing, but also any questions you might have about the astrophysics we've touched upon. Toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786, or email us forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Oscar-winning film editor Walter Murch, who, as we say... looks away from the big screen sometimes and looks toward the stars or goes down a rabbit hole, depending where you want to place him here. He'll be appearing in conversation with journalist, let me say his name right, Lawrence Weskler.
Weskler, yes.
Weskler. He said he's from a different dyslexic branch of the Wexler family.
He says it's from the dyslexic branch of the Wexler family.
And they'll be together at the Mechanics Institute this evening at the library there in the chess room here in San Francisco from 6 to 9, talking about these fascinating theories that go all the way back centuries in terms of astrophysics. We're also talking to Walter, of course, about his work. And we invite you to join us with any questions or comments you might have. You can do that by calling our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, or joining us by email, forum at kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment, or tweet us at our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. And I'm going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith, but I'll go back to Walter kind of describing the difficulty getting Wagner into Apocalypse Now.
Right. So we were denied the right to use the music by Decca, who were the company in question. So I went out to Tower and got every, I think it was 19 different recordings of the Valkyries that existed at that time, and played each of them with a stopwatch trying to match the meter that Schulte had used. It turned out that there was only one that was even anywhere close, which was Eric Leinsdorf, I think in the LA Philharmonic. The curious thing to me, which says something about the interaction of image and sound, was that I lined up the sound with the image, with the picture, the work print, and then pressed the go button, and it seemed to go okay for the first 15 seconds or 20 seconds or so. And then something very curious, sort of synesthesia happened, because the image of the sea, there's a series of shots looking down at the ocean from the helicopters. Suddenly, to my eye, the blue of the ocean didn't look as blue as it used to look. And there was something wrong with the music. And I stopped the editing machine and sat there for a while wondering, is there something wrong technically? What I came to was that Schulte, at that point in the music, had emphasized the brass section, and there was some chemistry between the hardness of that sound and the blueness of the ocean. Leinsdorf had emphasized the string section, and the softness of the strings made the blue look like the wrong kind of blue. So I phoned up Francis, and I said, you know, I don't think it's going to work. So he redoubled his efforts. He actually got through to Schulte himself. And once he did that, Schulte said, well, of course you can have it, dear boy. Why didn't you call me in the first place? So it all got happily resolved. In the end, the permission to use it came so late that we were never able to get the master tapes of that recording. So what's in the film is simply a lift from the LP, which, when you think about it, is probably what Kilgore would have had to do in the first place. So there's some justice to it all.
It's also one of those stories that say you go to the top right away, right? Or you should go to top right away.
If you can do it, do that, yes.
I just remember that Woody Allen line about Wagner that, you know, he heard a symphony and felt like he wanted to go out and conquer Europe.
Yep.
We're going to go to our calls and emails here. I just wanted to ask you about a couple of metaphors that have come up with this astrophysics sideline of yours, or down the rabbit hole, as you describe it.
Yeah.
I kind of found them fascinating. Bowling ball on a trampoline and ants in the microwave?
Right. It's the bowling trampoline metaphor is one that you encounter in almost every discussion of Einstein's theory of gravitation. His idea, which we now know to be true, is that large objects will distort the field of space-time around them, so that the sun, in a sense, is pulling the shroud of space and time tighter around itself, and that distorts the path of light that might be coming from the other side, from the star field on the other side of the sun. To conjure up a physical image for this, so they say, is imagine a bowling ball, and you put the bowling ball on a trampoline, that bowling ball distorts the space of the trampoline in two dimensions. Now they challenge you and say, now imagine this in four dimensions. What I'm arriving at also just as a metaphor is, yes, imagine this distortion, but imagine that there is also a rippling in the distortion, so that the trampoline, so to speak, has undulations in it that get greater and greater the further away you get. And you can think of the planets, or let's say the moons of Jupiter or whatever we're talking about, as finding a safe place in these undulations, which are in the safest place that I can talk about them is that they're statistical undulations. What the physical reality of that is,
who knows? Heaven knows.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you want to talk about the ants in the microwave?
Well, that's Lawrence and I get into a thing here. It's you can see this on YouTube. I would say don't do this at home. but if you take a microwave and put a piece of tape on the little rotating circle in the microwave, go out to the park or the backyard somewhere and get a cup full of ants. No ants are harmed in this, I should say. And then pour the ants into the microwave, turn the microwave on, and the ants will almost immediately scoot sideways out of the way of the microwave rays themselves, which are not, it's not a continuous field. It's kind of like blades of energy.
And you're not killing any ants.
And yeah, they don't want to get in the way of the microwaves because they don't want to be cooked. And so what you can do there is visualize these invisible forces by how the ants move. And it's a reach, but you can kind of think of the positions of the planets as finding an accommodating place between some kind of something that is causing them to be in the position that they are.
Let's go to our calls. All right. We begin, Richard, with you. You're on the air.
Yes, I heard a long time ago that, and I don't know if this is from the Buddhist or Tibetan tradition, that the cosmic sound of the universe was a B flat. Do you know anything about that?
You can Google universe and B flat, and you can get all kinds of interesting things. I did this actually a couple of days ago. It was a big item in the news about 10 years ago because we, that is to say, the human mind, scientists had analyzed a vibrational force coming from, I think, a black hole. And they transposed this into the auditory range many thousands of times. It's a very low sound, but they brought it into the audible range, and it turned out to be B flat. So, and the curious thing is, B flat occurs a number of times in the relative ratio scale of the orbiting planets.
We thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. But here's Kevin, who says, I've heard that black holes emit a certain variety of electromagnetic radiation that is, in some iterations, described as audible. I've heard similar things about the sonic qualities of cosmic background radiation. I'm eager to learn the difference between sound that can be directly heard, that which can be sensed, and that which can be transmuted into an audible form. Is there a difference?
Yes. He's asking this question that we just kind of talked about there. The black hole had a vibration at if you transpose it up in frequency to B flat. And I worked on a film, Particle Fever, a number of years ago, which was about the Large Hadron Collider. And they also can what is called sonify the interactions of subatomic particles. Everything at a certain level has a vibratory quality to it, and if most of the time that vibration is outside of the range of human hearing, but if you simply, in a sense, speed up the tape or in some cases slow it down, you bring it into the 10 octaves that the human ear can hear. It becomes audible. The sun, for instance, is pulsing. Its main pulse is once every 5 minutes. We can't hear a sound that's low, but in that sense, if you sped up the tape of the sound, you'd bring it up into the audible range, and it would exert a note.
You know, you're a natural teacher, Walter. Let me bring another caller in here, and let's go to Oakland. And Chris, you're on.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I had a question about a theory that I read some time ago. If you were to inscribe all of the platonic solids within the Earth, such that all the vertices and corners touch the surface of the Earth, that it would show you on the surface where things like tectonics and volcanoes and other naturally occurring features lie. And whether it merely stands to reason that these are mathematical truths that humans have figured out, or if there's actually something going on that's practical, and in terms of where you look for planets and where you might expect things to happen, and your actual practical understanding, or how music is a we think we've invented it, or is it some kind of underlying truth that that just stands to reason?
Well, to address the second part of that, there is a, let's call it a music, that exists completely independently of human beings. If, for instance, on Mars, if there was a sort of a bell-like rock, a rock that would vibrate, and a meteorite hit that rock, it would vibrate at a dominant frequency, just like a bell, but it would also vibrate at double that frequency and triple that frequency and quadruple that frequency and so on at diminishing intensities. And this is called the overtone series. And that is something that exists in nature, whether there are human beings or even if there's any life. It is just, that's the way things work. The great thing about that is that if the object on Mars vibrated at the note C, it would also vibrate at C an octave up, and then G, and then C again, and then E, and then G again, and then B flat, and then C again. And we find those notes very harmonic and pleasing. And those are the values of the relationships that I'm finding in the orbits of the planets.
Do you know about Mickey Hart's work with NASA? I mean, he actually.
Yes, I don't. I was with Mickey a couple of years ago at a tribute to Ray Dolby, and we talked about that. I can't remember all of the details.
He's
of
taking
it,
but NASA but it, sounds, basically.
It involves this thing of sonification,
right,
of taking things that don't have vibrations in the human range,
exactly,
and then somehow bringing them into, harnessing them and bringing into the human range.
And, you know, I'm also prompted to ask a little bit about silence in this whole context, because
sure,
The English Patient, and I remember the book that you did with Michael Ondaatje, who was the author of The English Patient. It was made into a movie, and Walter was involved in the movie in a very significant and singular way, as he has been in so many films. But, I mean, I'm thinking about that scene where the William Dafoe character, Caravaggio, is threatened with mutilation.
Having his thumbs cut off.
Yeah, and he says, don't mutilate me. And the silence
right,
really is so revelatory. I mean, you're using non-sound, really.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful quote from Robert Bresson, the French filmmaker, who said, the soundtrack invented silence.
Yes.
That film is uniquely positioned to utilize the visceral power of silence in a way that the other arts either can't do at all or can do only in very limited ways. And in every film that I work on, I think of the whole landscape of the film and then see, are there three or four places in this film where we could use a moment of silence that hopefully is also unexpected by the audience. And I move everything I can to create moments of silence, because it's also those places where the imagination of the audience kind of rushes into the gap that you've opened up for them.
Here's Ryan. Ryan, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I'll take my answer off the air. Good morning, Walter Murch. You are an amazing guy. I saw you at the mezzanine in San Francisco many years ago.
Oh, yes.
And it essentially changed my life.
Oh, boy.
I've been a digital audio guy ever since.
All right.
The question is this, and I didn't know how to, for Michael's sake, segue this. The question is how are you using, or what are you utilizing right now in line of digital workstations? Are you
right,
working with Ableton, some of the newer products? Are you working with Sound Designer still? What are you working with these days? And I'll take my answer off there.
Sure.
Thank you for the question.
I'm in a hiatus while I'm doing this book tour from a film that I'm working on in London. And I'm using Adobe Premiere, their editing system. It's the first time I've used it, and I'm having a great time discovering all kinds of wonderful things about it.
We thank the caller, and we go to another caller, and that's Jory. Jory, you're on the air.
Yes, yes. My question has to do with Bode's Law. I was wondering,
yes,
what exactly, there's something about frequencies and physical spacing of planets. What is your research working on? Are you trying to coordinate math or discrepancies with what the theory predicted, or what exactly is going on?
Sure. It's a version of what we were just talking about, of this idea of sonifying things that inherently don't have any sound. If you take the, for instance, if you take the four moons of Jupiter and compare their average distances from Jupiter, these are the so-called Galilean moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and you compare their distances, you get a series of ratios. Once you have a series of ratios, it becomes very easy to transpose those into musical notes. And so I'm going to play for you on the air what the four moons of Jupiter sound like transposed into music. If you hold on a sec here, let me get rid of these things, and here we go. So I'll play it once again. So those are the notes A flat, E, C, and B flat.
And it sounds, I hesitate to use the word, like something rhapsodic or spiritual.
Yeah, no, that's the amazing thing. We were talking about that a few minutes ago. The nature of harmonic music is that the tones exist in relatively simple relationships, simple fractional relationships to each other. And in astrophysics, in the relationship of orbiting objects, they, in a sense, like to be in simple relationships to each other for long-term stability. I think if there's any reason for this, it must be something like that.
And Tina reminds me of the about Jane Cardiff and Motet. Did you see them when they? Motet, when they were in town here?
I didn't see it. No.
Okay. Another listener wants to know, though, about Brian May, the guitarist of the rock band Queen, has a PhD in astrophysics. In addition to Walter, are you aware of any other artist astrophysics connections?
Yes, Brian May has a festival that he held on the Canary Islands, and I think last year the film Particle Fever that Mark Levinson directed, that I edited, David Kaplan produced, won the Best Film Award from Brian May. So I have a very friendly, I've never met him, but I have a friendly virtual connection with him. I think Brian Eno also has very similar, and David Byrne also has interests in this direction.
Yeah, in fact, David Byrne, I think, he's one of those who gives testimony to this book we've been talking about, Waves Passing in the Night, which,
yes,
again, let me give my recommendation to. There's a listener who says, I was wondering how the idea of dissonance in music and physics affects your consideration of the cosmos.
Yeah, I should emphasize that in the special case of these moons of Jupiter, those are what you just heard are the actual ratios that the moons exist in. In the solar system, the Bode's law says there should be this relationship. The planets themselves are sometimes 1 or 2 or even 3% off. So I could play you a very harmonic recital of what Bode's law predicts, musically speaking. If I were to play you the actual positions of the planets, it would sound slightly dissonant because, in a sense, they're trying to adhere to the landscape, so to speak, and they're doing a good or not so good job at it. But in general, they adhere to the Bode's law within 1-3%, except for Neptune, which notably doesn't fit. And there's a whole story going
part
on
of
there.
It's also alluded to in the book and
yes.
All. What is your background in music? Do you play instruments?
I don't. My father's family was very musical. He was a renegade. All of his brothers and his parents played music and had musical careers. He became a painter. So I may have adopted some of that predilection through the family, but I don't play a musical instrument. However, the mixing board on a film is kind of like a big organ, and you have to have some of the sensibilities of a musician in order to do a good job.
Well, we mentioned your father at the beginning of this interview, and here's a listener, Sandy, I guess, who's familiar with your father's painting. Sandy, go ahead. You're on the air with us.
Yes, thank you. I was very pleased at the opening of the show that you mentioned Walter Murch Sr. Mr. Murch's father was a great painter, well-known in his own time, and always included in the Whitney Biennials during the heyday of abstraction during the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
He was a great teacher and a friend and mentor of many young artists, and unfortunately, he died too soon.
Yes, he died at the age of 60, and it was a big shock, obviously.
Yes,
and he was really in the two or three years before his death, he was really accelerating into a whole other realm of his work, and so
he wasn't moving into abstract expressionism.
No, but the surface of his paintings were beginning to break up in very interesting ways.
Yes, absolutely. And he really deserves more exposure. I would love to see a major museum here do a retrospective.
Yes, I would too. We're actually working on a monograph of his work right now with 300 plates in it and six or seven essays. So we hope to get that out by the end of the year.
Well, stay tuned. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Sandy. Cameron writes, thanks for all your great work, Mr. Murch. I was surprised to learn that you worked on the Clooney film Tomorrowland, but didn't complete it. If possible, can you discuss the relationship between astrophysics and Tomorrowland, or lack thereof?
Well, I was attracted to the project because I've known Brad Bird for a long time, and we always were looking for ways to work together. And then this idea of working on a film that had at least some possibility for talking about these things. So I worked on the film. Unfortunately, the studio became dissatisfied with the film, and I was forced to walk the gangplank. They fired me about 6 months or so before the film was released, and another editor came in and completed the project.
No bitterness?
Well, it's a bruise, you know. It's a sad thing to happen.
Robert wants to know, what was Mr. Rich's favorite film to work on and why?
Oh, boy. It's I love them all, you know. It's like talking about your kids. Every film I work on, I apply the same intensity of focus and the same attempt to emphasize the good parts of the film and try to solve some of the problems with the film.
There's a lot of fun in doing that, isn't there?
Yeah. I because of the length of time that I was on the film, I would have to say Apocalypse Now occupies a big part of my mental real estate even to this day. But the short answer is that I love working on film. I love the collaborative process of it, and I love particularly the editing and the sound mixing and everything.
Ben wants to know, when doing war movies like K-19 Widowmaker, did you go out and visit the military machinery, or did you create the sound from scratch?
On K-19 and Jarhead and Cold Mountain and Apocalypse Now. I'm amazed that I've worked on so many films about war. It's all created after the fact. We can get some sounds at the time of shooting, but usually the conditions are not optimal for sound recording. And so we get what we can, and sometimes that works its way into the finished film. But as a rule, all of the military hardware and the helicopters and the tanks and the explosions and all of that stuff are either gotten from libraries or optimally gotten from special recording situations that we set up ourselves.
All that work on war movies color your view of war?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, I don't... There's a great line from Robert E. Lee where he says, "It's a good thing war is so terrible, otherwise men would love it too much."
That is That's a great line. I never heard that before. Here's Trudy, who writes, so interesting to hear of your early interest in sound as a young boy. I was reminded of learning about Tom Waits' similar interest in recording all sorts of sounds, even the inside of a rolling garbage can, and using it in his music.
Yes. It's worth remembering that we begin hearing 4.5 months after conception, so that our ears are sort of are plugged in halfway through pregnancy, and the womb is a very rich sonic environment. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, our mother's heartbeat is doing its thing, and her breathing and her intestines are doing their own little trumpeting, and the wall of the womb is no obstacle to sounds from outside, and the mother's voice and the voices of people all around. So the child comes into a kind of consciousness in the womb, which we can now document through sonograms, reacting exclusively to the sound environment they're in. The astonishing thing is that the first time the child ever hears silence is after birth, and it must be a kind of a frightening experience to hear the absence of something that you have come to accept as a continuous part of your existence.
Samuel Beckett's the only person I know who claims to remember being in the womb. Do you, Walter?
I don't. Although my mother sang to me in the womb, and she sang My Darling Clementine, and whenever I hear that, that song, I have a funny feeling, so maybe something.
Does that include the Bobby Darin version?
No, version?
No, it's kind of a spoof version, but yeah. It's actually pretty good. Always good to see you. Thank you so much for being with us. And you can see Walter Murch in conversation with journalist Lawrence Weskler tonight at the Mechanics Institute Library and Chess Room in San Francisco. That'll be from 6 to 9. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated in the evening. We remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Jeremy Siegel, and Susan Britton. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.